And our second case is Brizo LLC versus Uriele Ramirez Carbajal et al. And we have Mr. Pope and Mr. Massey here today. And Mr. Pope, if you are ready to proceed, please begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This is David Pope, and I represent the appellants in this matter, who are the personal representatives of Mr. Ixpa. And this matter concerns an incident that occurred during which Mr. Ixpa lost his life while performing repairs on a vessel in the navigable waters of the United States. So therefore, we believe this is properly an admiralty and maritime case that is being considered.
Mr. Pope, are you on video?
I should be.
There we go. Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't see that click to start video. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The appeal that we are considering is from an omnibus order of the district court, in which the district court granted all pending summary judgment motions and awarded Brizo, the vessel owner who had filed for exoneration from or limitation of liability, awarded them exoneration, no fault. The basis we believe, and the incorrect basis we believe, of the court's ruling was that this matter, the claim of Mr. Ixpa and the rights and duties of the parties associated with that claim and the limitation action itself, involved the Longshore and Harbor Workers Compensation Act remedy as opposed to a general maritime law remedy. The court emphasized in its opinion that this particular vessel, which the record evidence shows, it's the motor vessel Honey, which was, I believe, 163-foot yacht, otherwise classified as a recreational vessel, was docked at a marina facility in, I think it was called Old Port Cove in North Palm Beach, when the incident occurred. The incident actually involved hull cleaning on the motor vessel Honey performed by Mr. Ixpa,
Mr. Pope, can I interrupt you? I think we know those facts and we don't have a lot of time. Could you get right to the point in telling us why the district court was wrong?
Yes, ma'am. The Longshore and Harbor Workers Compensation Act itself provides in an definition of covered employees. And I better go first. The Compensation Act provides that it is the exclusive remedy for claims properly brought under it against the vessel for negligence. But during, in the act itself, in I think it's the 33 U.S. Code section 902.3, the act itself defines employee and says an employee does not include, and that's in subsection F, individuals employed to build any recreational vessel under 65 feet in length, or individuals employed to repair any recreational vessel without regard to length.
Mr. Pope, how is hull cleaning a repair?
Well, I would reference back to a court decision from this court in the, I think it's called the Aqua Clean case, that where the, as someone was sustained fatal injuries while cleaning a hull of a commercial vessel, not a recreational vessel, and this court fully approved the application of the Longshore Act to that activity as a repair within the meaning of the Longshore Act. The difference in this case is the character of the vessel involved and the particular provision of the Longshore Act itself. I do know that the note that the court referenced a catch-all phrase or provision at the end of subsection 3 of section 902, which said if individuals described in clauses A through F, and F is the one we're talking about, or I'm talking about, are subject to coverage under a state workers' compensation law. And the court, in order to uphold its determination that this case should be decided under the Longshore and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act, and in particular, which I'll address in a minute, the CINDIA duties under that act, that there was a provision in the state of Florida, since this incident occurred in Florida, act which removes, and this is chapter 440 Florida statutes, subsection 2, says that there will be benefits are not payable in respect of the disability or death of an employee covered by, and one of the options is Longshore and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act. The problem with the court's application of that provision as justification for overlooking the lack of Mr. ICSPA being a covered employee under the act and therefore his remedy subject to the act is that he was not, his activity was not covered under the Longshore Act explicitly in subsection F.
Let me ask you this, as far as the part about says the Longshore Act doesn't cover someone if they're subjected to coverage under state workers' comp law, as I read the record, my understanding is that the defendant made that a high point of their motion for summary judgment, and you never responded to that in your response. And the defendant then highlighted that again in their reply that you had not done anything to negate the notion that or to indicate your client was covered under state workers' comp. You didn't ask to file a surreply. You didn't file a motion for reconsideration. What is there in the record from your client to suggest he might have been subject to coverage under the state workers' comp law?
What I believe is makes the Mr. ICSPA subject to coverage under the act is the act itself. The act, Florida Workers' Comp Act, covers all injuries and accidents occurring in the territorial limits of the state of Florida other than those excluded. And clearly those excluded are those, one of which is accidents falling within the coverage of the Longshore and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act.
So we're since this circular situation.
Sorry, since this accident itself does not fall within the coverage, given that this is a recreational vessel, by definition, the incident involving Mr. ICSPA would fall within the coverage of the state act. I distinguish that as whether there was coverage under the state act. Just like in the Aquachem case, there was not coverage under the Longshore Act in that case, but that this court did said that's a different issue. The question is, does the act apply? And in Aquachem, they said it did.
Could I break in with another question? This is pretty fundamental to my view, and so I want to make sure we have time for it. To me, there are complicated issues, obviously, of what he's covered under and this and that, but no matter what scheme we're dealing in, is there evidence that Brizo actually acted negligently? It's obviously a tragedy happened and a horrible situation for your client and his family. But given the actual facts of what happened, no matter what scheme we're under, do we have evidence that the company acted negligently?
Yes, I will refer to the evidence and the deposition testimony of the vessel's captain, Captain Smart, and the vessel's mate, the vessel's mate, who was the actual person in charge at the time of the the bow thruster was turned on. The evidence in the deposition is that the captain had been advised that the date this incident occurred on the 27th, the captain had been advised, as he had been in the past, on the 21st of June, that there would be hull cleaning at the request of the vessel, at the request of Brizo, had been regularly performed on this vessel by Eastern Marine Services, that there would be somebody there at the 21st, at the 26th at 7 p.m. It turned out, and the captain acknowledged that that time was not appropriate because it was a 4-hour job and it was already dark, that the hull cleaning, but the captain had noticed the hull cleaning was going to take place, and the captain failed to advise the mate, who was the person in charge, since the captain had left the vessel for an errand on the morning Mr. Ixpa arrived and was not present, but Mr. Marks, the mate, returned to the vessel after the captain had left without the captain ever advising Mr. Marks that he should be aware of hull cleaning activity, given the notice that had been provided to the captain.
But the problem I see is that the notice said that the hull cleaning would happen the day before, and no one ever showed up. So it doesn't seem logical to me that the captain would assume that at any moment the hull cleaner could come by. I would think that they would assume that another email would say, here's when the hull cleaning will actually happen.
The testimony that we cited from Captain Smart was that it was quite often the case that there would be an email from Eastern Marine Services giving a time, and that they would not show up at that time, but would show up to perform the hull cleaning activity that had been requested. That is exactly the custom and pattern that it took place here. Brizo was aware through captain of the vessel that hull cleaning was going to take place. And I believe it is probative of fault on the part of the vessel that the mate, Mr. Marks, said that if he had been advised by the captain that this hull cleaning would take place, or that there was a hull cleaning notice of activity to take place, he would have behaved differently. And he including the operation of the bow thruster.
Mr. Pope, you have finished your time, but you have saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Massey.
Yes, good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jules Massey. I have the privilege of representing Brizo LLC, the vessel owner here. I'd like to address a few things that Mr. Pope has just raised. First of all, I think it is very important when looking at the application of the LHWCA to the negligence actions available to Mr. Ixpa's family, is that the words that Mr. Pope was using were covered employee. That is not what 905B says. It does not require, it actually doesn't require an employee. It says, and I quote, sorry, I had it up here. 905B, in the event of injury to a person covered under this act caused by the negligence of a vessel, then such person or anyone otherwise entitled to recover damages by reason thereof may bring an action against such vessel, and the remedy in this subsection shall be exclusive of all other remedies against the vessel except remedies available under the act. Where the language becomes very important is there are multiple rights that are granted under the LHWCA. One is the right to workers' compensation from an employer, which is why the employee definition becomes so important. But when it comes to the language actually used by Congress for the 905B negligence action, it does not use employee. That is very important, because I think that stops the analysis right there, because you have a traditional core maritime activity, which is a worker working on a vessel, not adjacent to navigable waters, but actually in the navigable waters. So this is another difference, is that many of the cases in the appellant's brief are talking about ship repairers, vessel repairers that work on land.
Let's assume we don't go with that argument. Let's assume, just can you proceed with your fallback position, which I guess is that he's still not covered under Florida state workers' comp laws, correct?
That is correct. There's nothing in the record that shows his eligibility for state workers' comp. And the very important legal principle here is that the LHWCA is the default. It's what provides the answer. The Florida state workers' comp is the exception to the LHWCA, only in very specific instances. In this case, there is no one. It's undisputed that he did not have any Florida workers' compensation coverage. The exceptions that the appellants are relying upon here only happen if there is state coverage. It's per se, it's one or the other. You can't have someone fall through the cracks in this.
Right. So now help us with that. Let's assume you're right. The Longshore Act applies. Let's assume for a moment. We'll assume in a minute it doesn't. Let's assume it applies. What negligence standard applies under the Longshore Act, and why is it that summary judgment's appropriate based on the ground that you were not negligent?
Okay. Duty is a legal question. Under the LHWCA, the duties of a vessel owner to a contractor and the contractor's employees, and there's some, it really is irrelevant whether ICSPA was an independent contractor or an employee for our purposes.
I didn't ask all of that. What are your duties? Let's assume. What are your duties?
The duties are, one, to turn over the vessel in a reasonably safe condition, so that an expert contractor can go about their work safely. That comes with it a duty to warn, but only of those things that an expert contractor should not already be aware of. Once the vessel is turned over, there are two other duties that arise. One is the duty to intervene, and this is the narrowest of the duties, which is that if the vessel is aware that there is a harm and has actual knowledge that there's a harm that's going to manifest to the workers and has actual knowledge that the contractor is not protecting those workers, there's a duty to intervene. And
so
then
these are the Scindia factors.
Okay? Correct.
The three Scindia factors.
Correct.
Explain to us why applying that test in summary judgment was appropriate to you. In other words, you weren't negligent.
Because there's only three duties and none of them ever arose. We have no duty to ICSPA. That is what the judge found, and she was correct. And I will say this is a most unusual case because there are no cases involving the Scindia duties that where anyone is fighting whether the vessel had been turned over or not. It's almost an unheard of situation. And in fact, the judge, Judge Rosenberg, in her summary judgment, talked about equating it to trespassing, because if someone actually comes to your vessel and starts doing work on it and you don't know about it, that's akin to a trespasser that you have no knowledge of and no duty has yet arisen, because it's very important. And this is the language of Scindia, and in Howlett, the Supreme Court says the turnover is when the vessel permits the stevedore or the contractor to commence working. I mean, the term permit is very important. So this is unusual because you just wouldn't normally have, under most circumstances, a stevedore sneaking aboard your vessel and starting to operate the cranes. That's kind of a ludicrous thought. Yet in the Chapman case, that's kind of what happened, which is a stevedore went on board a ship in the dark. The crew didn't know about it. He didn't ask for a light. He didn't ask. He didn't let any of the crew know that he was doing, and he was injured. The court found that there was no duty there.
Right. So that seems like, as Judge Grant was saying, it's pretty difficult if you have no idea somebody's under your boat to know you're not supposed to start the boat. And so that's the Longshore Act. Now, let me ask you this other question, because analytically, this gets so confusing. Let's assume for some reason the Longshore Act doesn't apply. We're just into the big nebulous world of maritime liability, just general negligence, not Cyndia duties. What's your argument as to why, if Longshore Act didn't apply, you weren't negligent?
Because even under a reasonable standard of care, there was no duty under this circumstance. And I look again to Judge Rosenberg talking about trespassing. We have to have a duty.
It's the same principle. If you're saying it's the same principle, if I don't know somebody's on my boat, as Judge Grant said, whatever the test is, if I don't know somebody's on my boat, you know, I may start the motor up. I just don't know. It's going to be the same sort of argument if the Longshore Act doesn't apply. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. I want to address the email because that, you know, seems to be the only avenue by which the appellant is suggesting that any duty might have arose. In other words, that we might have known somehow that ICSBA was working on the vessel at the time that he was doing. I want to point out a few things. The email very specifically says that the vessel's next hull claiming was coming up approximately 6:26 at 7 p.m. Now, that was the day before the incident that's listed on that email. The email further says, though, that our schedules, meaning Eastern Marine's divers' schedules, our schedules constantly change, so the date and time is at best, and it says at best, and then says a rough approximation. So not only is it just approximate, it's at best a rough approximation. Why is that? Because the divers are going to different boats, and they essentially wouldn't ever show up at the time on these emails. This was an automatically generated email that would just spit out. And what is the message of the email? The message of the email is your boat is on the list, but we don't know when we're going to get there. That's essentially what all of the information that Captain Smart had. Now, I want to point out something. It's clear in the record. Captain Smart left the vessel at 10:30. Mr. ICSBA was already diving under the boat when the captain left. So this idea that the captain, you know, if he had mentioned to the mate, which, by the way, he was asked completely speculative questions on improper hypotheticals about what he would have done if he had known something different. But the idea that if he had given the crew a heads up, as the appellants have suggested, some vague notion that sometime divers will show up, you know, this idea that he would have been giving that message to the crew when the diver was already under the boat. I mean, it's an extraordinary and tenuous burden to place upon a vessel that at some vague rumor that someone might be showing up to your boat, you need to be on like heightened alert. That's not the requirements. There's no duty for a moored vessel to have a lookout. I mean, that's part of maritime law. So to have a lookout for a diver to intercept them before they sneak under the boat and start working without your knowledge is just like a kind of a ludicrous duty to place upon a vessel owner, especially from a contractor who's in a far better position to guarantee their own safety. ICSBA didn't try to let anybody know that he was there. He didn't use the dive flags. We haven't even talked about the Pennsylvania rule. You know, he broke the law when he dove under the vessel. And yet, somehow the captain and crew, if they had had heightened alert, would have somehow prevented this.
Well, am I correct in thinking that the record had shown that in the past, Mr. Ixba and other divers, but Mr. Ixba in particular, would always let people know he was there. He'd knock on the door, make sure people know, as most of us would. You wouldn't get under a boat, you know, with a propeller. And at this particular time, it's undisputed he did not do that.
It is completely undisputed that he did not do that. And yes, the custom and practice, because that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Because if the schedule is fluid, you would only know that the operation was going to commence when the diver actually got there. And so the diver prudently would inform the crew, allow the crew to turn the vessel over under Cyndia in a safe condition, meaning that it would lock out and tag out all of the underwater equipment under the boat that could harm the diver. And it's not until the diver knows that that's happened that they would enter the water. This is the custom and practice. Now, was that there? Mr. Pope might mention that there was one time where the captain was aware that someone got in the water without letting anybody know. One time in a vast majority where this was the protocol. So at the end of the day, this is just an extremely unusual situation that, you know, once someone's under the water, there's no way to know that they're there. And that's what the Casaselli case, I think, is very clear about. The water in Northwest Palm Beach is very dark. Unequivocal testimony is that you can only see inches below it. David Marks, the mate who actually fired up the bow thruster, checked over the side to look, to see in the water. He saw no bubbles. He couldn't see anything. What more is a vessel owner supposed to do? So I agree with the court. This is a tragic thing. But at the end of the day, the legal responsibility rests with the diver who gets in the water, because the diver is in the best position to guarantee their own safety under these circumstances. And with that, unless there are further questions, that is all that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Massey. Mr. Pope, you have reserved 3 minutes. And Mr. Pope, let me just ask you something right off the bat. So
yes,
you have indicated that the piece of evidence that you're pointing to, I've noticed the clock is not ticking down, Ms. Geddes. I get it. Sorry. The one piece of evidence that you have pointed to show potential negligence on the part of the vessel owner is this email. What if we were to agree with you that this somehow put the ship on notice, that the diver was coming? It is indefinite. It says here's the first day and time that you might see that. What was the ship owner supposed to do with that? Be on notice for a day, a week, a month?
With respect to the notice, the passages we're talking about and counsel has referenced, this vessel was hull cleaned once a month by the same person, Eastern Marine, by different divers, not always Mr. Ixba, but others. It was always the same way. They would send a message. A diver would come sometime around when the message said. But with respect to the court's particular question, I'm going to reference back to a case where the master of a ship didn't disseminate information that the master had as to the particulars of the waters the ship was going to traverse, which resulted in a great tragedy in Tampa, the Skyway Bridge tragedy. And I'm particularly talking about In Re Hercules Carriers, in which this court, in affirming the denial of limitation to the owner of the Summit Venture, found as fault the fact that the master of the Summit Venture, when he did have knowledge that he should have transmitted to his crew So they would be better prepared for the waters they were transiting. And I will compare that to, so that Mr. Smart would be better prepared to decide whether he should or shouldn't operate the bow thruster until he determined whether there had been or had not been a diver dispatched to the vessel per an instruction or an advice he would have received from the master, but didn't.
Okay, but you're not disputing the fact that Mr. Ixpa did not notify the ship when he arrived and did not display the diver down flags, correct?
That is correct. I have.
Okay, so let's pretend that the ship captain tells everybody, hey, ship cleaning is going to happen soon. I'm not sure when. What else would have been done other than what was done when the sailors checked the water before turning on the thrusters? Your client violated maritime safety law by not displaying the flag and not announcing his presence.
Two things I will try to rush through. Number one, the testimony of Captain Smart is repeatedly says the divers did never use diver down flags. The ship wasn't relying on diver down flags to be alerted to the presence of a diver. They were never used in all the repeated hull cleanings that had taken place. The second thing is, what would have happened is exactly what the mate said he would have done if he had been advised that the presence of a hull cleaner was to be expected. He said what he would do. He would have paid attention to the cart that was on the pier right in front of him when he found out that there was supposed to be or might be a diver dispatched. He would have called Eastern Marine. That's what the mate said he would have done, but for the fact the captain never told him to expect or even anticipate something happening during the time he was in charge of the vessel, namely Mr. Smart.
All right, thank you, Mr. Pope. Thanks to both of you. We have your case under submission.